Accession number 27747, Reel 3.
Reel 3, Graham Pitt.
Well, we left the Tyne and went round the corner to Scapa. And there we went through the general process of working up and trying to get us into some state of efficiency. We did exercises in Scapa flow. I found my way about the ship, improved the mess deck by scrubbing it.
What exercises were you doing? Was the ship doing?
Oh, they were just steaming around, manoeuvring and doing dummy firing of guns. There's a thing called a sub-calibre firing. I don't know whether they did it in Scapa or whether they had to go outside for that. But as I understand it, you have a 6-inch gun barrel and you put some sort of tube inside, and then you're left with only a little diameter and you can fire a practice round. And that's called a sub-calibre firing. But it trains the lads. But we didn't have to... we were always busy in harbour because there are always stacks of official mail and things to be done, and the lads wanted to go ashore and have beer at the canteen, so they wanted money and so on. Of course, we used to pay the crew every fortnight, which was quite a performance, because we had to work out what each man was entitled to.
Did they have deductions ever for...
Oh yes, national insurance. You could be, if you lost stores, you could lose money for that, the value of the stores. Yes, I started national insurance when I was in the Navy.
What year was that? What year was that?
1942. Now, but at sea, we used to do cipher watches. The cipher office was quite comfortable. It was in a little office off the main wireless transmitting station, fitting with a bench, and the officer used to do the confidential work, and we used to call out, I think I can say this now, call out numbers. Dead boring, and if your chap was very slow, it could be a bit irritating. The padre was a bloody poor decipherer, but the others were quite all right. And it does teach you to look up references rather quickly, actually. But we used to do that about one watch in five, so at sea. And you were busy if you had the middle, you know, from midnight to 4 o'clock. It was usually about 4:30 before I could clear my mind of all the work. But we were also, of course, had a proper... They had a action cipher staff. We'll come back to that in several reels' time. But we also... If you weren't on that, you had what you might call a normal action station. And mine was down in the cordite handing room for Y turret. That would be... There was the turret on the quarterdeck. Then there was the cordite gallery beneath that. Then there was the stoker's compressor room under that, and if you ask me what they compress, I haven't a clue. And then there was the cordite handing room, which was a rectangular room, and nestling in an L-shaped arms of the magazine, which you got into through a hatch, or no, a watertight door, sorry. At one end of the handing room. There were four of us, or should be four of us, in the cordite handing room. Me, Stoker Harris, who used to be in a brickyard, labourer, nice chap, I liked him. Cook Mayer, who I think had been a sweeper in a newspaper office, he was a bit dim. Stoker Thornton acted. He was replaced by someone else, but they were a bit shadowy. The handing room had two hoists, which were staggered at right angles to the long limb of the L. And the cordite was stored in the magazine in sort of tin boxes. And there were five cordite charges in each box. So they had to open the cordite box, get out the centre one, which would be quite difficult because they were packed pretty tightly, and they put that on a rotating vent in the bulkhead between the magazine and the handing room. And somehow or other, I think they had a handle, and the vent, or the turntable, which was supposed to be flash tight, we never tested it, turned round, and there presented to me was this charge, which was in either a circular cardboard case about 2 feet high, or it might have been papier-mâché. And I would take that from the turntable and put it in the hoist, which had a series of buckets which you couldn't see, but somehow or other, when you slam the door of the hoist, the charge miraculously fitted into the bucket chain and was taken up top to the cordite gallery, where it came out at a fixed point. And then the chaps up there had to rush round the cordite gallery because this was at this stern of the guns, or the rear of the guns, when it was on a 4.5 line. But if they were trained to beam, the back of the turret was no longer positioned conveniently to the cordite, so they used to have to rush around and poke it up through the arse of the turret. So there you are. But I was so positioned that I could manage one hoist by myself. But Stoker Harris was alongside me, but further away, but he couldn't reach the other vent. Mm. So Mayer used to collect the charges and pass them to him. There was also a telephone up to the turret, which information used to come down. We might come to that, I don't know. And I think, there was a Tannoy connection as well, because occasionally we got a bit of information about that. Also, and this I didn't like, there was a valve with a wheel, so we could flood the magazine from down if necessary.
Oh, yeah.
And what was worse is they had a similar wheel on that spike, on that pipe, or piping, or whatever, shafting, up top in the cordite gallery, so they could flood us, which I didn't like.
Yeah.
But still, there we are. We survived. Anyway, come September, we were more or less fit for operational service. So we went up to Marlfield, which was one of the fields on the west coast of Iceland, and I suppose we refueled there. I know some of the lads got leave to Reykjavik, which was a couple of miles by drifter down the coast, but I don't remember. I wasn't one of the lucky ones on that occasion. And then we set off for our first Russian convoy, which was PQ-18. We were a very heavy cruiser squadron. where's that got to? Oh, here we are, I think. And yes, here we are.
So you're heading...
We're heading for in the general direction of Russia.
Yes.
That is the, you'll see there are 4 8-inch gun cruisers there. I've got a better photo than that somewhere. I don't know where the hell it's got to.
The ships behind, can you remember what they are?
Give me time, I know it's here somewhere. I know one is the London, and probably the Cumberland and the Suffolk, I should think. Here we are.
Scylla's convoy it's got here.
Yes, that's right, that's PQ-18, yes. That's my code for it. Norfolk, London, Cumberland and Suffolk, leaving Farfield. You see, it was a flat calm. It can be calm sometimes, yes. Thank God. Yeah. But we weren't really... the captain gave us a pep talk as we sailed and said, this extremely powerful squadron is available to deal with the Tirpitz. I thought, Christ. Because I think we would have come to a very sticky end. Oh, yes, here's another one. All those will have gone to the Imperial War Museum somewhere.
Yes. You took these photographs?
No. I better explain that, hadn't I? We had a couple of walrus amphibians on board, which were manned by the Fleet Air Arm, and they had, I think, 3 in each as crew, and I suppose they must have had some sort of, you know, maintenance staff. I don't remember them, but they also had a photographer who was called Bunny Austin, and his peacetime occupation was photographing debutantes, so he knew his way around. I think he had an eye for the ladies, but I had no authority for saying that. He had a little twinkle, which I think they would have liked. But he ran a photographic firm on board, and, you know, for 6 months or whatever, you can buy one of these. So he took quite a lot, and I bought quite a lot, and that's where most of these come from. I accumulated some others later on.
Would you have been allowed to take a camera on board?
I think so. Leading writer Patterson had a camera, and he took one or two, but he wasn't in the same street as Bunny Austin. But you had to... Austin, and I suppose Patterson, had to submit all the photos that they took to the captain of the Royal Marines, and if all was well, you got a nice little stamp on the back. Passed for transmission, but not for publication.
Very good, yes.
As it happens, because PQ-18 was a fairly hairy one, but by no means, we went off with some trepidation because we'd had 2 blows, actually, because when we went to Scapa, we joined the 18th Cruiser Squadron, which consisted of the Manchester, the Liverpool and the Sheffield. And soon after we got there, which would have been at the end of July, Manchester and Liverpool set off as reinforcements for Operation Pedestal, which was the reinforcement of Malta with stores, supplies, aircraft and what have you. Manchester was sunk, and Liverpool came back with a 60-foot hole in her, so the 18th Cruiser Squadron consisted of the Sheffield. So the Admiral lost his job because he had only got one, so we joined the 10th. So we became the 10th Cruiser Squadron after that. That was one, and because the other was the PQ-17, which was the previous Russian convoy, being a complete shambles with the... you may remember that the Admiralty had signalled the convoy to disperse, and a lot of the merchant ships were picked off by U-boats and so on and so forth. It was a right mess, so, you know, one set off feeling a bit relativistic. But we had a soft number, or as it turned out, because before we sailed, we had embarked a lot of cases which were stored in the flats, and I think we had some light anti-aircraft guns too, and also some Norwegian sailors. And when we got near to the Arctic waters, we and the Cumberland, I think it was, peeled off to go to Spitsbergen, which was... we went to a place called Barentsburg, which no one in their right mind has ever heard of, but that used to be, I think, a coal mining area, and had been much destroyed so that the Germans wouldn't get it. But the Norwegians had a weather station on there, and we went in after 2 o'clock because you could rely on the Germans to be of regular habits, and their reconnaissance plane always came across at 2 o'clock. So as soon as the 2 o'clock plane had gone, we pitched in smartly and anchored and ferried all these stores and the Norwegians ashore. And happily, the Cumberland, I believe, and I wish they'd been on board us, had some dogs, sledge dogs, and I suppose they landed them too. But anyway, that was that, and... we came back quite safely to Scapa.
How long did you stay there for?
Oh, just 4 or 5 hours. But it was quite a slick operation. But I had to stand on the catapult deck logging out the times of departure of the floats. Now, let me see, can I find it? Yeah. Nothing like good order and naval discipline, is there?
Oh, yes.
Ah, here we are, here we are, here we are. I think. That thing ticking away while I'm fiddling about with this. No, I'm sorry, but I have got a photo of some of them ashore.
What sort of time of day was it then?
After two o'clock.
Yes.
And we then came home with the London and the Cumberland. I've got some nice photos of that, and the best one, though, has disappeared, as you might expect. So that was that. And then we were, I suppose, in and out of Scapa on exercises. But the next thing was we departed Scapa for Belfast, where we picked up the Torch convoy, the really big one which features in all the pictures. And our ship figures in one of them, in one of the shots. And we took this convoy, which was largely consisting of passenger liners. I think there was 500,000 tonnes of shipping there. We took them right to Straits of Gibraltar. We went in...
How long did that take?
Ooh. Well, I wouldn't like to swear it, but I should think about 7 days. I think so. We nipped into Gibraltar and tied up alongside the Rodney, which was absolutely, the battleship was absolutely huge. And I think we refueled there. Then we went out again. Oh, yes, I've forgotten. Somewhere or other, I suppose it must have been in Belfast, the ship was already overcrowded because, you know, she was expected to have a complement of about 750, and with radar and all the extra AA guns, which had to be manned and so on, the crew must have been approaching about 900, so, you know, the conditions were not good. Mm. And in their wisdom, their lordships gave us 600 American Rangers, to which we had to take out. And these characters came on board, festooned with submachine guns and, you know, hand grenades and all the rest of it. And Jolly Jack was sloping around, pale, you know, big farm lads looking frightfully healthy, and Jolly Jack was sort of sloping around with a round back from sleeping in hammocks and a bit pale because, you know, the stokers never saw daylight and so on. But as soon as we got out into the Bay of Biscay, Jolly Jack went round in his round shoulders and went about his business, and the slop were flat out being sick. Which was rather funny for us. We got our convoy to North Africa all right. I don't think we really knew much what we were going to be up to. The ship astern of us, which was a merchantman called the Thomas Stone, was torpedoed, but she was the only casualty in the whole convoy, and it could have been a lot worse. And as it happened, she made it into port, so that was all right. We tied up, as I said, alongside the Rodney and refuelled. Then we went further along the coast. The Germans thought we were another Malta convoy, but of course, sometime or other, we must have been told we were going to have a go at the French North Africa. I remember that we went to action stations at 0200 on the morning of the 8th, and I was closed up in my cordite handing room for a long time. But one of the possibilities, of course, was the Italian fleet intervening, and as soon as the French realised we were going from them, there was a possibility of the French fleet at Toulon having a go. Mm. But in the event, it all passed off. We had a destroyer come alongside us, and we decanted our Americans into the destroyer. She went into Algiers Harbour with a view to seizing the harbour and the installations. I think they had a rather bad time, but I can't be sure of that. Then we stooged up and down a bit. And the next thing was, I think it was a Sunday. We were told that one of the forts which guarded Algiers was holding out. We were to bombard it. And I remember being on the upper deck at about 2 o'clock that day, and one of the disadvantages of knowing something about naval history is that you know have a pretty shrewd idea of the hazards. And of course I remembered that the British fleet had a poorish time at the Dardanelles. And it's not really a very good thing for ships to bombard shore forts, because if they fire at you, your hull is vulnerable to shell fire. Whereas if you fire at a fort, you've probably got, you know, 6 inches of concrete, 6 feet of concrete to get through. With the result that unless you can get a hit on the embrasure in which the gun is peeping out, it's going to be a bit tricky. So I have to admit that this was the second time in the Navy that I was scared. And I remember leaning up against the starboard torpedo tubes, thinking to myself, well, now father and mother will be in the garden gardening at this time, it being a Sunday, I think it was. And then I saw Donkey Bray and Topsy Turner, who were the two regulating petty officers. They're the ship's police, who are marching up and down on the other side by the port torpedo tubes, looking completely unconcerned. I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it, so that's it. But so we closed up at action stations, but as soon as we steadied to do our bombardment run, I suppose the French sensed that things weren't very good for them, so they started putting out white sheets. So, you know, they gave in, which was very satisfactory. Then we took some troopers further east along the coast to a place called Bougie, and saw them ashore there, and started back west again. It seems a bit odd, really. But it was just as well, because the German dive bombers came across and created havoc. I think all the troopers were either damaged or sunk on that occasion. But I think most of the troops had got ashore all right, so I don't think the casualties were bad. I've never heard so, but I'm not too sure of that. Well, then we were steaming westwards, and by this time, I should have mentioned that normally the crew of the Sheffield slept at action stations. We used to close up at 2100 and fall out again at about 0700. And to begin with, the Cordite crew used to sleep in the handing room, but that was most uncomfortable. And I forget how we managed it, but we were able to sleep later on in the Cordite gallery, which was a bit more comfortable, and there was some sort of Hessian mats on the deck, which made it just a tiny bit warmer. I was... We used to sleep in pairs, and as I was the junior to my mate, who was leading supply assistant Sheldon, I was on the inside, and this had the disadvantage in that the turret used to swing round, which meant, if you like, that the inner wall of the gallery moved, and there were projections on this, so it used to be moved every hour to make sure that it didn't freeze up and to make sure that, you know, everything was working properly. So I had to sort of turn on my side to avoid the projections. So I was never hit, but it was... I found that by putting my shoes opposite each other, so that the heel one, there's one heel to the right and one heel to the left, putting my gas mask on top of the shoes, I had quite a good pillow, and I used to put my Mac oilskin over me, and it really wasn't too bad. And if you're like me, you have a sort of flat part on your thigh, and you can lie on that on a deck and not get sore. So that may become useful to you sometime. Anyway, we were streaming back. And in the night, a minesweeper called the Cadmus met us on an opposite course and collided. It glanced all the way down our port side. I think it damaged the catapult and tore away some of the bulwark in the waist, and unfortunately crushed a stoker who was getting some fresh air up against a stanchion, and the poor chap was killed by the name of Spong. We buried him later. It's the only one of the few naval funerals I've been to. But we then proceeded back to Scapa Flow, and the crew, being frightfully patriotic and militaristic, were rejoicing over this collision, because we thought that with the damage to the ship, we would go into dockyard hands and have a week each watch. By that time, week's leave each watch. By that time, we had been in commission and away from civilization for 6 months, so we were getting a bit fed up. Perhaps I can digress there and talk about women. In the 9 months from July 1942 to March 1943, I saw two women. Both of those were ashore on Flotter in Scapa Flow. One, I think, was an army officer's wife who was following the troops. The other was a dear old lady who had no teeth, but she gave me half a dozen eggs, which I was able to smuggle aboard and get cooked. But
So you had no social contact?
No.
Outside?
In other words, at a time when I should have been developing, shall I put it crudely, relationships with women, and by relationships I've merely been friendships, it just wasn't on. Mm-hmm. You just didn't get that. That is one thing, looking back in my life, I regret, because I didn't have any sipping around. As it happened, I picked up a peach and that was fine. But if I hadn't have been, other people... I mean, I do resent that. Mm. But, you know, it's just one of those things. But everybody else was in the same boat, literally. But not a good way to spend a life. Well, now... When we moored in Scapa, to looking forward to going to the Clyde or the Tyne for repairs, judge of the alarm and despondency when dockyard mateys came aboard with repair kit. And it was obvious that we were going to be repaired in Scapa and we weren't going to the Clyde or the Tyne. And some of the wildest spirits overnight threw the dockyard mate's gear over the side, where they were subsequently recovered by divers, I believe. But, of course, the poor old captain had to go to the commander-in-chief and say the crew were emerging, getting very dissatisfied. So, on the 7th of December, a notice went up on our notice board saying, "We advise you to post your Christmas mail by the 12th of December." So,